All right. Well, welcome, and thank you all so much for coming out here this afternoon. From what I understand, this is the most exciting thing that is happening in Boston today. So we understand your interest in coming. In all seriousness, we're grateful for your presence, and we're really thrilled for this event. We've been able to assemble really an all-star panel here to discuss something that is current, and by current I mean just in the news today. If you watch the headlines, the state of New York or the city of New York, one or the other, just sued ExxonMobil. So this is definitely a present and pressing topic. My name is Joel Nolet. I am on the steering committee for the Federal Society's Boston Lawyers Chapter. It's my honor to sort of get to play host of sorts for the evening. One thing I do want to flag for your attention is that on Monday, we will actually be right back here in upstairs in the press room, from what I understand, and Attorney General Sessions is going to be here giving a talk, and we'll be having lunch. So if you haven't seen that, please be sure to sign up for or ask us about it, and we'll be happy to provide you more details. I am going to keep my introduction short. I am, however, going to introduce Lindsay De La Torre, who is going to serve as our moderator for the evening. Lindsay is the executive director of the Manufacturers Accountability Project, which is a project of the National Association of Manufacturers. Without further ado, Lindsay will introduce the rest of the panel.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Thanks so much for coming out, given the rain and the World Series. We'll try not to keep you here late, because I know you have pressing things to get to. But in particular, I want to thank the Federalist Society for hosting this, and Joel in particular for all your hard work in putting this together. We have a fantastic group of panelists, so thank you for your time here tonight. I know it will be a great discussion. Before we begin, I sort of want to give a high-level overview of where we are in the litigation. I know our panelists will fill in the gap, and they are each going to take 10 minutes at the top to give their perspective, so I won't speak long. But just to frame the issue, to date, 14 municipalities and one state have filed public nuisance climate lawsuits against energy manufacturers, including in California, Colorado, New York City, Washington State, Rhode Island, and most recently in Baltimore. Essentially, these lawsuits are seeking damages from energy manufacturers for public nuisance claims related to the effects of climate change. These cases are in various stages, but I want to highlight the most recent developments and decisions. On June 25th, U.S. District Judge William Alsup dismissed the suits brought by San Francisco and Oakland, holding that, quote, the problem deserves a solution on a far more vast scale than can be supplied by a district judge or jury in a public nuisance case. He also wrote that, quote, all of us have benefited. Having reaped the benefit of historic progress, would it really be fair now to ignore our own responsibility in the use of fossil fuels and place the blame for global warming on those who supplied what we demanded? And on July 19th, U.S. District Judge John Keenan dismissed the lawsuit brought by the City of New York. And in his opinion, he explained that, quote, the immense and complicated problem of global warming requires a comprehensive solution that weighs the global benefits of fossil fuel use with the gravity of impending harms. To litigate such an action for injuries from foreign greenhouse gas emissions in federal court would severely infringe upon the foreign policy decisions that are squarely within the purview of the political branches of the U.S. government. Accordingly, the court will exercise appropriate caution and decline to recognize such a cause of action. While these suits are working their way through the courts, I also want to highlight a few related cases, including a 2009 suit brought by the Alaskan coastal village of Kivalina that used similar logic to sue energy manufacturers. In Kivalina, an appellate court ruled that the federal action by the EPA displaces their claim. And of note, two plaintiff's attorneys who argued these cases are also attorneys arguing the appeals for the city of San Francisco, Oakland, and New York. In 2011, a Supreme Court case titled AEP versus Connecticut, and I know several of our panelists are experts on this case, in an 8-0 decision authored by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the court held that, corporations cannot be sued for greenhouse gas emissions primarily because the Clean Air Act preempts these claims. I will note, as Joel mentioned in a timely development today, Acting Attorney General in New York filed a lawsuit against Exxon claiming that the company defrauded shareholders by downplaying the expected risk of climate change to businesses. I know that will be an interesting topic for discussion here today. The suit was brought using under the Martin Act, a state law that gives her power to investigate and prosecute securities fraud. So with that, I will pause. You know, I think here we are left with what all does this mean for litigation in this area, and where do we go from here? I know that our panel has a lot of great insights. So with that, I will take a minute to introduce them, and then we will get started with the debate. First, I'd like to introduce Stephen Ferry. He's a professor of law at the Suffolk University Law School here in Boston, where he teaches both environmental law and energy law. Professor Ferry has published multiple editions of Environmental Law, Examples and Explanations textbooks. I feel like there's a few of his students maybe in the audience, and he's written extensively on the subject. I mean, they get an automatic A, right?
It's in the book.
Next, I'd like to introduce Phil Goldberg. He's the managing partner of the Washington, D.C. office of Shook, Hardy & Bacon, as well as director of the Progressive Policy Institute Center for Civil Justice. Among his relevant expertise, Mr. Goldberg has offered briefs in AEP versus Connecticut, which is the case I just mentioned. Next, we have Don Cochin, who is the Parker S. Kennedy Professor of Law and the Associate Dean for Research and Faculty Development at Dale E. Fowler School of Law at Chapman University. Professor Cochin is also a visiting scholar in residence at the Center for Constitution at Georgetown University Law Center. Professor Cochin has written extensively in law reviews, op-eds, and blogs on the subject that we're discussing today. Next, we have James May. He's the Distinguished Professor of Law at Widener University Delaware Law School, and co-founder and co-director of the Dignity Rights Project and the Environmental Institute at Widener Law, and an adjunct professor of graduate engineering and former chief sustainability officer at Widener University. He's litigated hundreds of public interest environmental claims across the United States in both state and federal courts, and wrote the law professor amicus brief in AEP versus Connecticut. Finally, we have Ken Reich. He is an experienced lawyer with a nationwide reputation and his practice focused on environmental law. Prior to forming his own law firm, he spent 7 years in the U.S. Department of Justice, first as a trial attorney, then as an assistant chief, as well as working at a number of law firms. He is also an adjunct faculty member at Boston University School of Law, where he teaches environmental law. So, as you can see, we are very lucky to be joined by this distinguished group, and I will pause and hand it over to Phil to start us off.
I'm gonna stand up at the lectern if that works for folks.
Sure.
Your professors are used to doing that. You guys have been all the time comfortable being up at the lectern. My name is Phil Goldberg, as Lindsay said, and I'm a public policy attorney, which generally means that I work with my clients on the larger liability issues like this, rather than work with them on the in specific litigation. This is an issue, and these are a set of cases that I've been following for a number of years. I first met Professor May, I can't remember exactly how many years ago, but I probably can look here. In 2012, we were at a Valparaiso University Law Review symposium on these cases, and we all had our good works published, so I happened to bring it with me. I figured maybe Professor May will sign it over to me and give me his good autograph on it. To set the stage a little bit for this dialogue, I know we've got some practicing lawyers here, we've got some law students here, maybe with some tort professors in the room, so be careful how you answer this, but who knows what a tort is? Does anybody want to? Great. So if I were to sell you this pen, the mere act of selling you this pen, would that be a tort? No. I wouldn't think so.
You don't know what's in that pen.
Is the mere act of selling a gallon of gasoline a tort? That is really what this all is about. In all of tort law, what the common links that run through all of tort law is there has to be wrongful conduct that caused some sort of compensable injury. And in the tort of public nuisance, which is what all this is about, all this litigation is being filed under, the question is there wrongful conduct? And in order to answer that, you have to look to see if there's an unreasonable interference with a public right. And so selling a pen or selling a gallon of gasoline is not, in my view and those of the of courts that have ruled on this, an unreasonable interference with a public right. It's not wrongful conduct. Because what the companies are doing here, as several courts have explained, is that all they're doing is selling the fuel that we all want and need to fuel our cars, to heat our homes, to turn on our lights. And so then if you kind of run through the other torts, like whether negligence, there's no tort duty not to sell these products. There's no design defect. Release of carbon dioxide is an inherent aspect of a natural resource. And there's no causation and even traceability in these cases to any one company's product or conduct, because this is about 150 years of carbon dioxide being accumulated in the atmosphere around the globe, and again over 150 years. So it's not caused by any specific regulation, corporate conduct, or even any type of fuel. And it also doesn't have the hallmark of what we look for in tort law when we're trying to regulate behavior through tort litigation, which is, this is what you're doing that's causing you to be liable. This is why that's why it's based on wrongful conduct, and here's what you can do to not be liable in the future. And so there is nothing that in this litigation where you would say, here's what what these companies can do to not be subject to liability going forward, other than not to sell fossil fuels. And so if there's no legal basis for this litigation, then what is this litigation all about? And it's really about politics. The plaintiffs and the communities that have brought these have expressed that they're trying to advance a political agenda against fossil fuels. They're frustrated that there's not enough occurring in Washington, frankly, and they want and they're hoping that the threat of liability and massive liability can bring industry to the table. And so the first wave of these lawsuits were brought when Bush was the president in the early 2000s. And these were AEP, Comer, Kivalina, and General Motors. And all of them were lawsuits against private companies and utilities over the sale and use of fossil fuels. Each case was packaged slightly different from a legal perspective and kind of a combination permutation of how public nuisance cases can be brought. But they're essentially all the same, and the motivations were the same. The Maine Attorney General said, it's a shame we're here trying to sue companies because the federal government is being inactive. The plaintiff's lawyer in Comer said, our primary goal was to say to defendants, you are at risk within the legal system and you should be cooperating with Congress, the White House, and the Kyoto Protocol. And so the first wave of cases, as Lindsay mentioned, failed. In AP versus Connecticut, it was rejected unanimously in an opinion written by Justice Ginsburg. The technical ruling was about displacement, but she didn't stop there. She went on to talk about this is an issue of national legislative authority, that judges are not equipped to be, in her words, a super EPA, and that there's no parallel room for tort litigation. And the other cases, the circuits that were hearing similar cases at the time, got the message loud and clear. And the Kivalina in the Ninth Circuit wrote in Kivalina that it would be incongruous to allow the litigation in any of these other forms. And the Comer judge said that, you know, acknowledged they're doing nothing more than lawfully engaging in their respective spheres of commerce. So then you have the second wave of cases that are going on over the last couple years, and there's an attempt to really trump up the wrongful conduct element and try to make salacious allegations. What it boils down to, and as the judge in Oakland, Judge Alsup, said, it's really that the allegations are these companies knew about climate change and they still marketed and sold their products for use anyway. And that they should have been trying to facilitate a transition away from fossil fuels to renewables. The remedy was not as outwardly as regulatory as, say, AP versus Connecticut. It was this, they say, it's all about money. We want money for local projects like seawalls and other things that have to be done in order to protect against the impacts of climate change. And so whether it's seawall in Imperial Beach or New York City, I submit that building seawalls and making energy companies pay for them has as much to do with climate change as Trump's wall has to do with immigration. These are purely symbolic in nature, and they're meant to drive media, not necessarily to deal with the underlying substance. And what, there's an environmental lawyer, and I'm sure I'll mispronounce his name, and maybe one of the folks here know, Dan Riesel or Riesel.
Riesel.
He was involved in framing some of these litigations and said that the pleadings were intentionally written like press releases. He said, quote, "We have to take private action because the party that should be regulating the environment is doing jack." That was his words. Probably cut off a little bit too soon. So the as Lindsay said, in Oakland, Judge Alsop, who was a Clinton appointee, called it a sweeping proposition that otherwise lawful and everyday sale of fossil fuels, combined with the awareness that greenhouse gas emissions lead to increased global temperatures, constitutes a public nuisance. He said that the question of reasonableness, again, we go back to, you know, it's unreasonable interference with a public right. He said the question of reasonableness falls squarely within the type of balancing best left to Congress or diplomacy. The New York City case focused a lot more, the judge there really focused on the national and international implications of regulating CO2 emissions, saying it would, quote, be illogical to allow the city to bring state law claims when courts have found that these matters are areas of federal concern that have been delegated to the executive branch as they require a uniform national solution. And then the third set of cases, which, as we heard, there's been development today, where the New York Attorney General or Acting Attorney General sued ExxonMobil under the Martin Act, really is about some of the same conduct issues that are at issue in these tort litigations. The state AG there is saying that it was securities fraud to not be honest with the with shareholders that the climate change could have an impact on ExxonMobil's business of selling fossil fuels. And a corollary to that, there's Massachusetts Attorney General filed a civil investigative demand a couple years ago to investigate the same type of questions. And ExxonMobil has a petition pending with the U.S. Supreme Court to step in and try to stop that civil investigative demand. And the issue there is really all just about jurisdiction. Can the state of Massachusetts, do they have jurisdiction over these national, international issues when the conduct that they're alleging didn't necessarily take place or have a sufficient connection to the state of Massachusetts? So what's the Massachusetts role in all of this? And so in conclusion, and I'm really looking forward to hearing the remarks of the other folks here, really, I'm sure, dive into some of these issues in a lot more detail. You know, being in Boston, it reminds me of Secretary Rice, who was Clinton's labor secretary.
No relationship.
I'm sure you're equally as smart as he is and equally as effective.
That's a tall order.
He's a brilliant person. Yeah. But he, in the 1990s, he called suits like this, this is obviously before these lawsuits were filed, he said they're faux legislation which sacrifices democracy. He said this is not the proper way to set political or policy issues. I would submit that this is not the way to set national energy policy. We are all responsible for the use of fossil fuels, and it's a political decision for these specific defendants to be sued. It could have been any defendant, any companies, it could have been any users of fossil fuels. There was a political decision to go after the producers of oil and gas. These lawsuits try to focus our energy policy only on concerns about the environment and climate change. But there's a lot of other issues that go into setting national energy policy, from energy independence to affordability, national security. And so, and these lawsuits don't let us really get at any of those other issues. And finally, I just, as we kind of go on to the, you'll hear from the other speakers, this idea of litigation by localities over things like driving national political decisions or policy decisions, or paying or requiring manufacturers or private interests to pay for local infrastructure projects, is really at the forefront of a trend of litigation that we're seeing in a whole bunch of different areas around the country. And so there's a lot of layers that we can talk about later, but there's a lot that is at stake, I think, in these litigations and how this debate gets played out. So with that, Lindsay, I'll pass it back to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Phil, for your insightful comments. Thank you also for staying at 10 minutes.
Did I?
You did. You did. I'm keeping time over here. Next, we have Professor Ferry. If you'd like to give us your insights, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, we've got to switch this computer. I've got to unplug this. Back up. Let's see. Maybe get an assist up here. Is it going to come up? I don't know. No? Okay.
Give away your password.
I know. This will not be on the test. Okay. Let me see if I can get this thing running and we'll run here. Okay, so I'm going to diverge. I thought I might be going a little bit later, but. Okay, now we can move along. I'm going to diverge from this entirely and let others talk more about the case, and since I'm going earlier rather than later. Again, there are a large number of lawsuits, more than a dozen. They are concentrated in California, which for a later slide makes some difference. And the bases here are, A, that there's no jurisdictional basis to bring these suits. They're non-justiciable, which means this should be the executive branch, politicians deciding this, not individual judges with juries or without juries. Displacement, which I'll go into more in a minute here. And also, interesting issues come up in each of these two opinions that have been rendered as to why are you suing the oil companies for making a product as opposed to the people who put it in their cars and their furnaces and burn it, which is an interesting aspect. So anyway, the courts, again, I'm going to go very quickly because I brought more slides than I have time to show, but basically two Supreme Court cases at the bottom, the Ouellette and the Silkwood case, basically say that common law claims survive federal regulation. And Kivalina was mentioned. Again, let me skip over because others are going to talk about Connecticut versus AEP. Let me skip over that. But in the bottom of that chart, again, the Third Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, for example, are split as to whether common law claims are or aren't preempted. Nuisance claims are common law claims. So it's still, at least in the lower courts, somewhat in dispute. Here's the difference between displacement and preemption. Displacement is basically a horizontal or lateral pushing out one level of our balance of powers. It says basically if the Environmental Protection Agency regulates something, the courts do not have a role in regulating it. It basically displaces the role in that way, so among federal branches. So again, when the federal government occupies the field, the common law is displaced. Preemption is more vertical. It says the higher level of government, if it acts at the federal level, preempts or supersedes, I'm not going to use the word trumps, supersedes the lower state level common law regulation. So I'm going to go through these. I'm going to let others talk about this, but just note this is the California ruling. Just one or two of the things I've bolded because we have so many speakers. Again, they did not bring the claims against the emitters, which are you and me who drive and take subways and do other things. They tried to attack this worldwide, not so much for carbon in the U.S., but carbon internationally. There's no U.S. jurisdiction outside the U.S., which is an interesting sidebar. And all of us have benefited. This is the California decision. The New York decision here, it's displaced, it's extraterritorial, you're reaching outside the U.S. So let me skip over this for a second. So I want to diverge from this for my remaining 9.99 minutes, which I still have, Lindsay, right? I want to diverge here and say what is happening here. President Trump is changing NEPA, which is the consideration of CO2 impacts on the environment, as well as trying to either repeal or replace the Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama administration attempt exclusively with the power sector to cut back carbon emissions from fossil burning power plants. He was going to repeal it. Some of his lawyers said, let's replace it with something called the ACE, which I'm not sure exactly what it means, but it does fit in a Twitter, so it's short. So in any case, he is replacing it. That may be essential here in some ways. Let me come back to that in just a second, that he's replacing it. If he leaves a gap, interesting question I'll let others address, whether that makes some of the claims of common law active again because they are no longer displaced by the EPA deciding to be active and regulate carbon. And again, it's not replaced yet. So where are we? Most articles now say we are doing terribly in meeting our international commitments to Kyoto and its successor, the Paris Agreement of 2015. I want to talk about Chevron deference disappearing, which I think is going to make carbon regulation harder in the future before my 9.98 minutes are now not available. Okay, so where are we on the Paris Agreement, which President Trump is also attempting to pull out of? It's going to take him 4 years. We will have another presidential election before that can be successfully done. But there are a number of articles out there that tell us that carbon dioxide is still increasing. And it is increasing, but not from the United States. In the United States, it is decreasing. And so without the Paris Agreement, again, let me just make this real quick. We had to hit an agreement here by 2020 to reduce 17% our carbon emissions, and by 2025, reduce them 26 to 28%, which is a 300% increase over business as usual projections. So again, we're pulling out of this agreement at least for now, but this we had to hit 26 to 28% 7 years from now if we stay in. There are a number of law articles out there. This one just came out where people are saying it's rising each year. Again, that's only true if you don't look at the U.S. They accuse the U.S. of this. Here's where we are, and I've got a graph that will say this better, but we are already at 26 to 28% reduction 7 years before we have to in the power sector. So in the power sector, because of natural gas substituting for coal, a huge amount of renewable energy coming up, we are essentially hitting our Paris Agreement objectives. The Obama administration Clean Power Plan said that was only going to cost us $8 billion a year. That has been enjoined by the Supreme Court. I'll come back to that in just a second with my 9.97 minutes left here on this. But we are basically there. So if you look at a graph, this is independent research by the Rhodium Group. You can see 2020 on the bottom graph. We are already at 26 to 28%, which is in the power sector, at least, where we need to be. The Clean Power Plan was going to take us down 32%, only in the electric power sector, by 2030. And we are within 4% of that 12 years before we had to hit it. So the U.S. is actually doing fairly well with all of this. This is something that Jerry Brown and Michael Bloomberg published 2 weeks ago. This is their plan as to how they think we should get there. The left bar is how much carbon reduction we need to eliminate climate warming from the U.S. Almost all of it is going to be that third one over with the 620 on the top. It's all power sector. So their view is that we don't do much with transportation, which is almost as large a share as electric power. We don't do much with our homes, which are a smaller but a significant impact. We're going to just keep leaning on the power sector till it does it all. It's going to be harder now because of three Supreme Court decisions that I will very quickly go through to enact this legislation going forward, no matter which administration is there. So Trump administration is deleting consideration of CO2 in NEPA statements. They are also stopping counting international benefits of carbon reduction and what are called co-benefits. Most of the reductions of the Obama-era programs were not because they reduced carbon, but because they caused coal plants to shut down, which decreased other pollutants that are regulated under other parts of the Clean Air Act. And again, I'll take questions on that if people have them, but in the interest of time, let me just sort of state that as a given. There are three Supreme Court cases, and how am I doing on time, by the way?
You have 9.99 minutes.
Fantastic. I feel like the guy in the ad who talks really quickly for Federal Express or something. Okay, so anyway, there are four recent Supreme Court cases that I think make it extremely difficult for the EPA to regulate for carbon, and I think they fundamentally change Chevron deference, which is the foundation of administrative law out there. So again, there's a 2014 decision. I've got multiple slides on this, but let me just use this as a summary and we'll skip over them which follow this. There's a decision, these are all pretty much EPA or Federal Energy Regulatory Commission cases. They're all Supreme Court cases. I've got articles out there if people want more information about them. On the first one, the 2014 decision, EPA tried to tailor a regulation that was basically a carbon-directed regulation. And they were supposed to regulate a large number of emitters for carbon, for mercury and carbon. And so what they did instead is they said, well, we're going to discard regulating 99% of them because it's too much of an effort for us. And that was held by the Supreme Court, that the EPA can't fudge and use its discretion to change what the statute says. Again, these decisions only affect EPA in theory. Then in 2015, an important decision for a couple of reasons, Michigan versus EPA. I know we have a new Supreme Court justice as of about 3 weeks ago. He was the dissenting opinion on this in the DC Circuit. The Supreme Court 5-4 reversed and adopted his opinion. In his confirmation documents, he said it was one of the 10 most important things he ever did in life. I think the rest were drinking beer, but I won't say too much about that. So he certainly believes that this is an important decision. That was a decision where they overturned an EPA regulation where EPA refused to look at the costs compared to the benefits before issuing the regulation. Again, this is on coal plants, that's largely carbon and some other pollutants. They did not say how the EPA had to consider costs, but arguably now the EPA cannot promulgate a regulation, perhaps, unless maybe the costs are justified by the benefits. In the EPA programs, if the Trump administration removes consideration of international benefits and co-benefits, the programs go from being very highly cost-effective to zero cost-effectiveness. All the benefits are either international in the Clean Power Plan, for example, or co-benefits of regulating what's called particulate emissions from shutting down the coal plants as opposed to the carbon. I know that sounds like a lot of moving pieces. The second 2015 decision in West Virginia versus EPA is something the Supreme Court has never done in anybody's lifetime in this room. The Supreme Court shut down the Clean Power Plan, which is our carbon control mechanism out of the Obama administration before it ever had a case before it. The case had not been decided by the DC Circuit where it was. The DC Circuit refused to enjoin the program during the Obama administration pending appeal, which was going to take a year or two. There was an appeal on that refusal to enjoin to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically said, does anybody know in this room to the attorneys arguing whether we've ever done this before, and nobody could think of a situation. And they shut down the Clean Power Plan on carbon before the case had even gotten to the DC Circuit and certainly before it had gotten to the court. And they didn't just shut it down by reversing an opinion. They said the entire program can't move. So that is interesting in relation to carbon. And then there's also a case, Hughes versus Talen Energy. That's a not an EPA case, but it is energy-related, where individual state action, and again, these are state suits, to try to control certain electricity, certain incentives for certain power plants in their state was held to violate essentially the preemption clause of the Constitution. So let me sum up here. So again, these are my
1 minute.
In the middle, it flies so quickly, doesn't it? So with 1 minute, let me go past all these cases. These are more details. Let me just put up this one for a minute. Chief Justice Roberts is now called our swing vote. He calls, in Michigan versus EPA, not making something cost-effective, which these carbon regulations would not be unless you consider international benefits. He calls it an in-run around the statutory language. In other opinions, he calls it, it's a danger posed by growing power of the administrative state. It's not rational, never mind appropriate, to impose billions of dollars in costs for a few dollars, et cetera, et cetera. So let me go over this again. This is the Kavanaugh dissent that got changed. This really changes Chevron deference to now where there are some limits, at least on the EPA, only one agency, in using discretion to enact something. So
again, the co-benefits, basically what happens here, the cost of the Clean Power Plan was $5 to $8 billion a year. The benefits were domestically $4 to $6 million. So $5 to $8 billion in costs, $4 to $6 million in direct benefits, unless you considered something other than the carbon benefits, which is all was being regulated. A lot of the red states that are red on this map were the ones who sued. A majority of states sued under the Clean Power Plan. It was more than half. And that's been enjoined now for 3 years. It'll be 3 years in February. And nothing has moved at the D.C. Circuit. So since the Supreme Court enjoined the entire program, the D.C. Circuit so far has refused to issue a decision so far on the basic thing. So let me just go through all of this. So where are we on all of this? It's interesting here. I think if the Trump administration merely repealed the Clean Power Plan, perhaps that activates again the common lawsuits not being displaced by the federal regulation. If he replaces it with something else that's much, much less dramatic, arguably there still is some regulation, and perhaps these suits are still displaced that others will address. So I'm going to leave it for questions and answers, and now I'd be happy if Lindsay would introduce my cohorts here.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for your insights into the broader environmental landscape. You gave us a lot to think about. Next, I want to hand it over to Professor Cochin. I'm sorry, I gave you a yes, your turn.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you to the Federal Society for organizing this event. Thank you to Joel and Lindsay for helping to organize it, and to my fellow panelists for being involved in this discussion. I want to start with focusing on three sort of preliminary remarks in response to Professor Ferry's presentation, and just make sure that we're setting the stage for a full understanding of some of what we're talking about here. The first thing I want to make sure that people understand is the Northern District of California and the Southern District of New York both decided that climate change was real, or at least that was their determination that ultimately was in existence, but that we were going through it the wrong way, right? If we want to actually solve these problems, the judiciary wasn't the right place to be. So first off, this is not necessarily a debate over the climate science. What I'm going to talk about in part is, to the extent any of that kind of debate is involved, or to the extent that you want to decide how to actually approach potential solutions, that just belongs elsewhere, and that's really what those two courts were both saying. The second thing is, you'll notice that, although we only have 10 minutes to talk, so it's not fair to make this criticism of Professor Ferry, but you notice how much was focused, in fact, on administrative and legislative solutions. And in fact, much of the chart showed you the ways that those things might actually be helping to alleviate some of the problems that are associated with climate change. There were no charts, and I don't think you could actually come up with any charts, which actually show you that public nuisance litigation would be effective at solving climate change, right? That it would actually have an impact on it overall. So we should be asking ourselves what, in fact, is the effectiveness of the strategy behind these lawsuits. Related to that, I would ask you to pose this question to yourselves. If we trust judges to make these determinations, remember, these judges determined, at least in these two cases, that climate change does exist. I don't think that, and then they decided that it wasn't the right venue, that instead it should happen elsewhere where we solve these problems. What if those courts decided to rule that climate change was fake? Climate change was not real. Would we trust judges to be making that determination? They close out the political debate by making a judicial determination that we are supposed to respect somehow, that in fact there is no climate science which can justify regulation. If that were the case, I think people would not be trusting judges. Yet that is a perfectly possible outcome when you place it in the hands of a non-deliberative body in which you don't have electoral checks on their behavior. So you need to be careful about trusting judges, because they can go against you as much as they can go for you. The third thing is where the focus of my points will be, and that is that no matter whether or not we have a displacement theory here or not, I think that there's a potential for actually damaging the institutions by trusting the judiciary to do some of these things, and that's where I want to focus much of my talk. Themes about largely what is the comparative institutional competency of the respective branches that can address this, and then secondly, to debunk the idea that that common law actually captures or should capture this kind of evolution in legal standards. So first ask yourselves, what's the appropriate role of the judiciary? What's the appropriate role of courts in a system of separated powers? Many of you know the typical federal society chant that, in fact, judges should say what the law is, not what the law should be. And in fact, that is embedded in Federalist Number 78, where Hamilton says, whoever attentively considers the different departments of power must perceive that in a government in which they are separated from each other, the judiciary